Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha. This is Science Weekly for October the 8th. Coming up on this week's show, Craig Venter tells us about gambling with the building blocks of life and how he's more nervous about publishing his autobiography than his own genome. Also in the show, Mark Buchanan will be telling us about social physics and applying mathematical and scientific principles to the study of human behaviour. Plus, the gay bomb, sword swallowing, and the problems with indexing your music library. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Welcome, listeners, old and new. Things are looking good in here, let me tell you. Joining me in the pod this week is science correspondent James Randerson, sporting one of his more conservative shirts today.
Well, I thought I'd kind of fit in with the somber mood in the pod. It looks like you've just come from a funeral.
I met the Prime Minister today, I'll tell you. That's why I'm dressed like this. Also in the pod here is Hazel Morris, who was the winner of our Facebook 500 competition. Say hello, Hazel.
Hello.
And you've also brought your sister along.
Hello.
Lindsay, you're actually a nurse.
I am a nurse.
Someone with a real job. How does it feel to be amongst us wasters?
I feel quite privileged.
Good.
In a funny sort of way.
And Hazel, you're going to get married in 2 weeks, I believe.
2 weeks today. I'm very excited. I couldn't concentrate on science at all today.
Okay, well, you might hear about it on this pod later. Science Weekly producer Ben Green's also here, and for the third day in a row, he's wearing a tie, although it's quite a horrible tie.
I think it works well with the rest of the outfit.
Welcome to the theoretical physicist, author and journalist Mark Buchanan.
Thank you.
Mark, welcome. Mark, we'll be hearing from you in just a little later in the show about your study on social physics. But first, let's have one of those sting things. Craig Venter is someone we've spoken about once or twice in the show before. The Vietnam vet and former surfer has spent the past 20 years cultivating his reputation as the bad boy of science. I promise that's the last time I'll use that phrase. Most famously by winning the race to sequence the human genome in the year 2000 and then, last month, becoming the first individual to publish their own DNA sequence. Well, Venter's just written his autobiography and he claims that he's more nervous about that than publishing his own genetic code. The Guardian's Ed Pilkington met up with Venter in New York City and asked him if he had any fears about mapping his own genes and, in a way, getting a glimpse of his own future.
Being able to predict and know the exact day you're going to die, I'm not sure that's such a horrible thing. I mean, it's part of what I've argued is that if people really knew that this is our finite time, this is our existence between the beginning and whenever we die, that's our time to make a contribution.
So you feel you could cope with that information? Obviously, you don't have it,
and
won't have it for many years. But if it does ever become possible, you could cope with that.
I would like to know it, actually.
You would actively like to know that?
Yeah. I may not tell my family if I know. It depends what the news is, right? but I would like to know that. You know, genetics give us odds, right? You want to find a way to beat the odds. You know, the genetic code will never tell us. You know, I don't care when it is in the future, it won't tell us the day or the year that we're going to die. It will tell us that we have bigger risk for certain things. In fact, knowing of those risks, what I like is it gives me the ability to do something about it.
Right, so let's run through some of those things.
Okay.
I mean, you mentioned a few in your book, and maybe there's the more that you haven't written in the book. The obvious one is the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So you're taking statins.
Yes.
And you're exercising and you've got a diet.
You know, that's one of the ideals is as we get information about our own metabolism, our own lives, that I don't think there'll be customized medicines for us, but there should be customized diets. You know, we are also environmental animals as well as genetic animals, and so a diet that works for me may not work for you.
In terms of the other things that your genome reveal a slight proneness to, just rattling through them, alcoholism, risk of blindness you mentioned, and dementia. All those areas, as you say, are so poorly understood, there's nothing that you've been able to do bar drinking less. But the other one I found really intriguing was the ADHD part of the genome, and which sort of kind of fits your memories of your childhood about being a quite sort of vivacious, hyperactive kid. And you have a line in the book in which you say, you know, nowadays you'd be on Ritalin.
Yeah.
And actually that opens a thought for me because, you know, come the day when the genomes are common, individual genomes are common and actually better understood than they are now, it is possible that children may be found to have ADHD genetic characteristics. Mm. And there are drugs to treat that to cope with the symptoms. Now, it made me wonder, would you have gone on to do whatever thing you've done if you hadn't been a very hyperactive, slightly troubled, kind of slightly manic kid?
Yeah, no,
maybe there is a danger.
It's a great question. And there's a definite danger. I think there's a danger in too many kids being on Ritalin anyway, but we have this certain regimentation with education system in general that is, you know, my genetic code didn't fit in well with the education system that was designed mainly for rote memorization of things. And perhaps if I was put on Ritalin, I would have done much better in my first 12 years of school and probably been
And you'd be an accountant right now.
Yeah, that possibly. You know?
That was Ed Pilkington speaking with Craig Venter. And you can hear more of that interview as this week's Science Extra. It's the first of 3 half-hour conversations with the leading biologist that we'll be podcasting over the rest of the month. Head back to the blog or iTunes for more. I'm Alok Jha, you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we'll be finding out why the common cold is being used in cancer treatment. Plus, that apparently is the sound of a gay bomb. Well done, producer Ben. You're very pleased with yourself, aren't you? We'll be hearing more from Mark Abrahams about that and the rest of the quirky science featured at last week's Ig Nobel Awards. First, though, why does the stock market fluctuate between peaks and crashes? What causes a previously harmonious community to break out into inter-ethnic violence? And perhaps less importantly, why is a new bar popular one week but completely empty the next? Well, someone who can perhaps shed some light on some of these subjects is theoretical physicist Mark Buchanan. He's an advocate of what he calls social physics, the study of group human behaviour using techniques from physics and maths. Mark, tell us, first of all, give us a brief outline of what social physics actually is.
Okay, there's been a movement amongst physicists and increasingly many social scientists to kind of use some of the inspiration from ideas in physics and physical sciences that have been so successful in understanding patterns in the natural world, to try to understand patterns in our world as well. Social scientists, for a long time, have tended to think that the human world is extremely complicated, we can't understand it, and what must the reason be for that? Maybe it's that people as individuals are just really complicated. You know, psychology is deep, and therefore social science has to be done in a way that's totally different from physical science. It's increasingly becoming clear that that's kind of a logical mistake, that social science might be complicated even if people oftentimes behave in fairly simple ways.
Well, you hardly sort of contain your contempt for social sciences in a sense. I mean, what do you think they've done wrong? I mean, are they just overcomplicating things?
Well, my contempt is only for a certain, you know, subset of social scientists. I think traditional economics has been the model for how social science should be done. It's very mathematical. And the reason it's very mathematical is it's based on this simplifying idea that people as individuals are always fully rational, that we use our calculating minds to determine our behavior, and we're also very self-interested. We're kind of greedy biological creatures. It turns out that if you make those assumptions, you can build mathematical theories, which unfortunately have nothing to do with reality and don't explain markets very well and don't explain hardly anything very well. So there's been a kind of revolution in technique in the past 10 or 15 years. There's many social scientists, economists who have started doing real experiments with people. They bring them into the lab, set them up in a situation where they have, you know, financial interest, they mimic a market, and they look at how they really make decisions. They make errors, they act on instincts, they make use, you know, hunches. They don't rationalize things out and just make, you know, rational decisions. And by beginning to learn some of these simple rules for how people make decisions, you can then step back and try to reason out what is this going to lead to when you get 10 or 100 or 1,000 people together? What are the patterns that emerge that propel social groups forward, often in very unexpected and unpredictable
ways? Given the sort of randomness and irrationality that individuals will demonstrate, how on earth can you then use simple law of physics to predict that person's behavior?
Right. This is a kind of paradox. How is it? Can it be that if individuals are very unpredictable in their behavior, how can you get patterns at many people? But you know, you see that in physics all the time. The individual molecule is very noisy, chaotic. It does everything, you know, unpredictably. It's hard to figure out. But in a liquid or a solid, you know, this cup of water in front of me is a liquid. It's staying a liquid. It has certain properties, very definite, very regular. So just because things are random at one level doesn't mean they can't be predictable.
So it's a statistical level you're talking
about.
Right,
exactly. Things average out, and you get patterns at the larger level. And this is true in stock markets seen across the world. If you look at the statistics of how they fluctuate, you find very similar patterns in all different kinds of markets, even, you know, across cultures, across, you know, from commodities to equities and so on.
James, you've got a question?
Yeah. Can you give us an example of a case where, you know, this has worked out quite well, that physical laws seem to predict the behavior of a group?
I think I might as well stick with the markets, just because that's a topical one. In classical economic theory, the idea was that a stock could never be overvalued. And that sounds crazy, but in fact, the theory said, well, people are rational. Rational individuals would never overvalue a stock. Therefore, stocks must have their actual values. Then some economists said, well, maybe that's not quite true. Maybe some people are irrational, but the really rational, sophisticated traders will take all their money and drive them out of the market. Now, none of those theories could ever explain why sometimes you get sudden mass movements where a stock market will drop, say, 20% in one day. And you find that markets are actually susceptible to large one-day changes, much more so than other natural systems. And to try to explain this, there's a lot of work going on now, some led by physicists. In fact, the director of the computational finance division at Oxford is a physicist, where they use simple models. You model individuals as simple people who try to kind of look at the past and use ideas about the past to predict the future. You put them together where each individual's actions feed into the world that other people are trying to predict. And oftentimes you have to use computers or sophisticated mathematics to see what kinds of things come out of this. And what you find is this natural tendency for the system to evolve to a state where one person's decision can lead to affect another person's decision, and you get avalanches of behavior that run through the system. And out of this, you find this kind of great susceptibility to sudden changes that can transform a market, you know, in ways that no one would have expected it to.
That sort of game that you're describing, putting people into a situation and seeing how groups of them behave, I mean, it sounds a lot like the kinds of simulations evolutionary biologists do with how species work and so on. I mean, is there a parallel at all there?
There's very, very much so. And in particular, in some cases, the parallel is extremely close. For example, you know, some of the experiments that economists have do is they've brought people into the lab and set them up in situations where, say, two people can do better if they can manage to cooperate with each other. You know, there's some real money at stake given by the experimenter. And the traditional theories say, well, these people wouldn't be able to cooperate because they're self-interested. Real people across the board, across cultures, do cooperate. There's a strong tendency to look for a sense of justice, and we can both do better together if we can manage to cooperate. Trying to explain where that personal attitude and preference for justice comes from means looking into our distant past, looking into evolutionary history. You know, the world we're used to today is totally unlike the world that all of our ancestors grew up in and evolved in. 99.9% of human history is, you know, we were small bands of 25 people on essentially a camping trip that lasted a lifetime. And
sounds like the science desk.
Yeah.
I wish there was 25 people.
So one of the ideas that comes out of some of these simulations is that where this cooperative tendency came from is that it enabled groups to coordinate their activities very effectively for collective defense, for collective hunting, and outcompete groups that didn't have members who were so cooperative. So, you know, that cooperative tendency that we have deep in our own emotional system probably came out of a long process of self-organization and pattern formation in evolutionary history.
A couple of the examples you use in the book are pretty contentious phenomena, like racism, like the violence that happened in the former Yugoslavia, you know, inter-ethnic tensions, that kind of stuff. Suggesting that physical laws can somehow explain some of those things must get physicists into trouble sometimes, I can imagine.
I think so. I think physicists can be arrogant, and they can be too arrogant sometimes. But there are a lot of scientists, political scientists, social scientists who have been inspired by this way of thinking and are taking it forward. And, you know, I think the point is to be clear about the logic of what causes things. If you're not clear about the logic, then you're never going to have a hope to really get a good understanding. So the one thing you mentioned was what causes racial segregation and what makes it so persistent against apparently all efforts to get peoples to live in more integrated communities. And an idea, one idea that's in social science is that, you know, there's the obvious idea was people are racist and that's the trouble. But there's an idea that certain simple mechanical factors can lead to racial segregation persisting just by the fact that people who are even willing to live in integrated neighborhoods may have a small tendency not to want to be part of an extreme minority. If you look around yourself and find you're the only one of your type and there's 98% of the other type around, you may feel slightly uncomfortable because of cultural differences and like to go somewhere else that is just a random mixture of people, you know, just a 50-50. But it turns out, and some computer models show this, that this small tendency to not be an extreme minority leads quickly to a very large segregation. So if you don't think that, if you don't keep that in your mind, you're going to be off on a tangent and perhaps find the wrong explanation.
It sounds
isn't there a danger though that people could jump on that and say, well, maybe, you know, this segregation is, you know, it's not really anyone's fault. It just happens. You know, racism isn't as big a problem as the Democrats make out in
right.
or there's, something like that.
There's clearly a danger, and so it's very important to say that teasing out this logic doesn't say that racism isn't important. Racism does exist. It's very important, but there's this other factor, this kind of mechanical process as well, and what we see in the world is presumably an outcome that involves both these factors at once.
Well, that's pretty fascinating stuff. Mark, we're going to leave that there. If you want to hear more about this subject, check out Mark Buchanan's book, The Social Atom, and we'll probably be blogging on this as well. Okay, now, time to get up to date with the rest of the science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. News
Jack. Exposure to secondhand smoke for people working in bars and clubs has dropped by 95% since July the 1st ban on indoor smoking in England. Exposure prior to the ban was equivalent to 190 cigarettes a year, but dropped to the equivalent of 44 cigarettes afterwards.
British scientists have genetically engineered a virus that usually causes heavy colds to attack cancer cells. According to researchers, viruses potentially offer a more targeted way to treat cancer than chemotherapy and with fewer side effects.
The Amazonian wilderness is at risk of unprecedented damage from an ambitious plan to improve transport, communications and power generation in the region, conservationists have warned. They say that boosting trade links between 10 economic hubs on the continent could see the loss of an entire Amazon jungle within 40 years.
And finally, it weighed in at more than 200 kilos and was armed with sharp 7-inch canines. No wonder then that the ancient saber-toothed cat is thought to have been a fearsome killer, but new research shows that it probably had a puny bite after all. A computer simulation has found that the cat's narrow jaw restricted its killing behaviour, meaning it could only bite at a third of the strength of a modern lion.
Ben and James, you silky voice newsreaders, thank you very much for that, both of you. James, let me pick up on the cancer story, the fact that a cold virus might be the best way to kill cancer cells. Tell me more.
It's fascinating research, I think. This is adenovirus, which causes heavy colds, and it's been genetically engineered so that it basically attacks a sort of molecular switch on the outside of cancer cells, which, for some reason, the researchers aren't really sure why, triggers a kind of self-destruct mechanism, and also at the same time seems to boost the immune system so that the immune system attacks the cancer as well. And also as a third effect, those cancers that are starting to become resistant to the chemotherapy drugs that a patient is on, the virus manages to somehow slightly reverse that resistance as well. Now, it seems as if they don't quite understand the molecular details behind all these different factors, but between the three of them, it looks really promising as a way to treat cancer, and so they're going to be moving into patient trials.
Mark, an interesting new avenue for cancer prevention?
Well, it sounds fascinating. It just shows you the upside of genetic engineering. You can make these objects, viruses, which are so much more powerful than just a cocktail of chemicals. Mm. I guess the downside is we don't really know how it works, and we don't know whether it could potentially attack other cells that, you know, in unforeseen ways as well.
Well, I suppose that's the sort of million-dollar question. I mean, the problem with chemotherapy drugs is they tend to be designed to attack cells that are dividing quickly, and so that's why they attack cancer, but it's also why people's hair falls out, because, you know, hair cells are dividing quickly. But they're also potentially attacking every cell in the body, and that's why you feel so bad when you're on chemotherapy. The researchers think these are going to be much more targeted because this molecular switch, although it exists on immune cells as well, it doesn't seem to have the self-destruct potential on those cells. And right. Again, they're not really sure why, but it seems to work. But interestingly, there are lots of different virus approaches in the pipeline. Some of them act in different ways, but there are quite a few companies around the world trying to develop genetically engineered viruses that attack cancer. And there are actually two drugs on the market in China, although it seems as though the trials weren't done very well. They weren't blinded properly, so a lot of people are a bit sceptical that these drugs actually work.
Okay. Well, don't forget to add your thoughts to any of these topics at the Science blog. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. Now then, some pioneering research into a gay bomb that makes enemy troops sexually irresistible to each other has scooped one of this year's Ig Nobel Prizes. The awards are now in their 17th year and are intended to celebrate the unusual, honour the imaginative, and spur people's interest in science, medicine, and technology. I just want to say that actually the gay bomb didn't actually ever get made. Well, you'll hear more about it in a second. Other winners included work on treating hamster jet lag with impotency drugs, extracting vanilla from cow dung, and the side effects of sword swallowing. Well, I spoke to Mark Abrahams, friend of the pod and founder of the Ig Nobels, the morning after the prize ceremony.
We were up very late. The ceremony, I think, went really well. We got overwhelmed afterwards. The amount of attention this gets goes way up every year. And as soon as we got back and started dealing with all the inquiries from around the world, I ended up being up until about 3:30, and there were several other people who were over here, and we were all working away. We got up this morning and discovered that our website got so much attention that it got smashed to smithereens, and then we discovered that one or two other websites of people related to the ceremony got so much attention, their websites got essentially destroyed for these short periods of time. But we're happy, we think.
It's not too bad. Next year, just get bigger servers. You know, this is obviously a monster you've unleashed. Let's talk about some of the prizes you gave out. We really loved the sword swallowing prize. That was the Ig Nobel for medicine.
Of course you loved the sword swallowing prize. How could you not? This was the medicine prize. It went to a team, Brian Whitcomb, who's a doctor in Gloucester in the UK, and Dan Meyer, who's in the U.S. in Tennessee. And Dan is the head of a sword swallowers association. They won for a report that they wrote together and published in the British Medical Journal. It's called Sword Swallowing and Its Side Effects. That's exactly what it's about. They surveyed a large number of professional sword swallowers about the medical difficulties they've encountered.
Certainly something not to try at home there. But let's go on to something a bit more peaceful. The Ig Nobel for peace was to a curious proposal for a bit of research.
The Peace Prize this year went to the Air Force Wright Laboratory in Dayton, Ohio. And the Air Force Wright Laboratory won the Ig Nobel Peace Prize because they instigated research and development on a chemical weapon, the so-called gay bomb. This weapon is intended to make enemy soldiers become sexually irresistible to each other.
Do we know if they actually ever made this thing?
Here's what we know. There is a document which was obtained by some reporters a couple of years ago under the Freedom of Information Act, which describes this project and some equally imaginative pieces of research. The purpose of this document was to send up the chain of military command to try to get funding for the research. And we've tried to check pretty extensively. We've talked to people who worked in the lab at that time, and it seems this document is quite genuine. When I talked to some of these people, some of whom were pretty high up in the administration of the laboratory, they told me that if this project did get funding, it would immediately have been stamped secret. And so I remember quite well what one of them said, which was that, and if that happened, I wouldn't know about it, and you would have no way ever of knowing that this proceeded. It's entirely possible that this only was a proposal for funding from the military scientists. It's equally possible that it got lavish funding and the research was done and that it's in use somewhere.
Well, let's hope not.
I've talked to a large number of people in the last 12 hours, and the reactions seem about equally split between people saying, let's hope that this wasn't done to... I hope it was done, because this might have interesting uses in the civilian side of things.
Yeah, how on earth would you do it? I don't even want to contemplate how you get around it. But let's move on to another prize, though. This is a problem, you know, I'm sure I and a lot of listeners have in our iPod generation. You know, you're scrolling through your iPod and you're looking through down the list of tunes, and actually a lot of band names begin with the. How on earth do you index all this stuff?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Before iPods and things like iPods, it's a problem that was well known and that a lot of people encountered, but now it's become a widespread, well-known problem, the problem. It's also the problem, when the title of something begins with the word the or begins with the word a. How do you classify them alphabetically? A woman named Glenda Brown, who lives in Australia and who is a professional indexer, wrote an article describing all of these problems and also describing some of the techniques you can use to deal with them. She published this article, this study, in a journal called The Indexer. And this is a beautiful and concise exposition.
Does she come to any conclusions, any advice? What shall I do?
It's akin to the advice that a doctor gives to a patient who has a chronic illness, that there's no true way to solve this problem, but there are some good ways to deal with it on an ongoing basis.
Well, that was Mark Abrahams, the editor of the Annals of Improbable Research and founder of the Ig Nobels. Let me throw this Ig Nobels thing out to guys in the pod here. Mark, James, any favorites from the list of 10? And we talked about three of them already, the gay bomb, supposedly, the sword swallowing, and, you know, any that you guys picked out?
Well, I was intrigued by the physics of crumpled sheets.
The
Tell
physics
me more.
Of crumpled sheets? Well, I don't know anything about them, so I can't.
Really? You wrote the story. Which ones do you know about? And I'll ask you about them.
That's a good idea. All right, hang on. We need to work this out better in that case. I want you to say something hilarious about it yourself.
Oh, right.
I don't want you to ask me. I don't know. What am I going to talk about? Start that again.
Okay. How many times have you taken your hamster on holiday?
I don't have one, but if I did, I'm taking him all the time.
Well...
I mean, I wouldn't leave it at home. It'd just die.
Yeah.
I wonder, what would happen if it got jet lag?
Well, it's a good job you asked.
Yeah.
Some researchers from Argentina have discovered that Viagra is incredibly useful for
curing
jet lag in hamsters. It does make me think that, you know, that might have just been their animal of choice, you know, to test their theory on.
Are they that rich anyway. Over there that can just use Viagra for random tests like this? Anyway, tell us about some more.
Okay, well, there's the physics of crumpled sheets.
Physics? This is your bag, Mark.
Well, yeah.
Physics of crumpled sheets. What do you know about this?
Well, it sounds ridiculous, but in fact, there's some connections between that kind of thing and earthquake science.
So there's real value to be had from these studies. They're all genuinely published, too. Tell us one more before we stop this silliness.
Can you tell the difference between a person speaking Japanese backwards and a person speaking Dutch backwards?
You know, I can't, but I wonder if anyone else can.
Well, you're in good company, because rats can't either.
That's incredible.
Ig Nobel Literature Award, you know.
I'm shocked.
That's pushing back the boundaries. That's
actually shocked.
Okay. What's their sort of their motto? Science that makes you laugh and then makes you think.
That's right. Oh,
thinking.
In the olden days, it used to be it celebrates research that cannot or should not be reproduced. We'll leave that there, I think.
Hi, folks. This is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
Okay, time to pull the plug on this week's shenanigans. My thanks, of course, to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, our guest Mark Buchanan, and the prize-winning Hazel Morris and Lindsay, of course. Guys, have you enjoyed this, or has it been a completely random experience?
It's been great fun. Yeah,
Have you? Are you going to tell good stories about us?
Absolutely.
And please
keep
the secret thing secret. Don't forget that you can listen to the first in our series of conversations with Craig Venter as this week's Science Extra. Next week, we've got a jam-packed show filled with interviews from the likes of Bjorn Lomborg and Steven Pinker. So listen in for that. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green this week, and I've been Alok Jha. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.